is The Thing About Cars, a podcast for car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Okay, welcome back. This is The Thing About Cars again in the studio with
Becca
and
Ben
and
Misty.
Misty's our audio engineer, and I'm Mickey. And this time we're recording in Strongbox West, which is this cool little office sharing space in Atlanta. If you haven't checked out Strongbox West, it's worth checking out. That's strongboxwest.com for us since we were coming into the studio today. And one of the questions that came up was from my friend Brian Wilson, who says, okay, this might seem silly, but what do you do when you get ants or insects in your car? He says, I bet there are some people out there that would want to have some opinions on that or options on that. So I think I have a couple ideas, but I know Becca's got a solution or a potential solution. What do you do,
depending
Becca?
On
right.
You may hate it when I say it. Well, if it's ants, the problem that I had was more insects in general, mm-hmm. from a car that had been in long-term storage. So it wasn't ants per se. If it was ants, the first thing I would do is move the car to make sure you're not on the source of the ant to stop anybody else from coming along. But also the thing that I had done, instead of trying to spot treat or get in the nooks and crannies or what have you, I went out and I found a bomb that was non-residue, electronic friendly, and set it off in the vehicle. That way, it's working more into the nooks and crannies. It's designed to not damage all the various wires running through the car, and I'm not going to end up with a film on anything. And I had thought that I would still need to do a touch-up around the car, still expecting to feel something, and it was absolutely clean. Nothing left after the bomb, all bugs dead. You know, it seemed to work really well.
Huh. What do you think, Ben?
That sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It sounds like it checks all the right boxes.
Well, I had this problem. This car that I just bought had, unfortunately, a lot of crumbs and edible organic things in between the driver's seat and the column, or whatever that thing is called, the console. And I parked it in my garage. And the next day it came out, and I noticed there's one or two ants on the steering wheel and a couple ants on the dashboard. And I picked up a friend for lunch, and she's like, Mickey, there are ants all over this car. And I'm like, what? Then we looked under the seat, and it was like Ant Metropolis under the seat.
Wow.
So what I did is I literally took the seat out of the car and vacuumed everything up. And then I got Home Defense, which is this product made by Ortho. And I diluted that, and I just sprayed the carpet in the car. It doesn't smell, but it seems to have done the trick.
I have one other suggestion as well. After you've cleaned the vehicle, it might actually work with ants while they're in there.
Yeah.
Ants are apparently deterred by the smell of peppermint.
Ooh.
I even have peppermint plants I found and put at my windowsills in the kitchen where I was having a hard time at home. They've stopped coming in the window.
Right.
But you can buy pure essential oil peppermint. So maybe if you go in and do that, even without using something strong, clean everything up. And if you're okay with smelling peppermint while you're driving, maybe put some of that around and see if it helps keep them away.
I was going to say, your car will forever smell like Christmas.
Yes.
There you
yes.
go, yeah.
Or a gun commercial.
Or a gun commercial. That's not a bad idea. I've heard diatomaceous earth works well for fleas. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it works on ants.
I don't know how I feel about sprinkling diatomaceous earth everywhere.
Well, it's edible grade diatomaceous earth, so they use it in and around kids and pets and everything. So it's
I don't think it's toxic, but say if it's in your house or in your car, wouldn't it bug you when you step on it?
I don't know. It's a good question.
No pun intended.
Right.
Yes, no pun intended.
So yeah, I mean, I suppose you use it long enough to get rid of the bugs and then you just vacuum it all up, but I don't know. Brian, hopefully somewhere in there you've got an answer to your ant/bug problem, assuming you have one, because you didn't actually say that you had ants in your car, but...
And it might be a good idea, too, to think about the root cause, you know. Well, I think that got mentioned, but yeah, do a good thorough going through the car, make sure there's not something in there, because you never know what you'll find.
Especially if you have kids. And yes. I'm looking directly into the microphone when I say that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, when you have to actually pry the stuff out of the creases in the back seat, you're thanking God that you have bought leather seats instead of cloth.
Right.
It was, yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean.
And I read a story in Car and Driver many years ago, back in the 80s. They had a long-term test car that developed the most horrendous odor. I think it was a Toyota MR2 back when those first came out. And, you know, there's a logbook that all these test cars, you know, had. Anybody in their office could take the car. They had to log what they did with it. But it was all part of, you know, putting the miles on for the long-term test. And one person finally got so sick of the odor, they took the car to the dealer and said, "What's going on?" The dealer probed around, found an old tuna fish sandwich under one of the seats.
Oh, no.
Yep.
And after, and this was recorded in the logbook, and then somebody noticed a few lines later in the logbook, somebody wrote, "Oh, so that's what happened to it." So if you have multiple people in your car or multiple people in your family who use the same car, you know, things like this can happen.
Why doesn't everybody think, "Hey, I was in the car when I lost something. Maybe I should look under the seats."
Right?
"Hey, John, have you seen my tuna fish sandwich? I lost it 2 weeks ago."
Oh, it'd be more like, "I'm leaving the car. I don't have my tuna fish sandwich. Right. Where did it go?"
Good grief. I've had rental cars. They're supposed to clean them, but there's one major rental car company that essentially, they tell you up front, they won't clean the car, but if you clean it, they'll pay you for it. So if you come back to the shop with a car wash receipt or something, they'll take that out of your rental fee because you're doing their job for them, right? It's like lowering their overhead.
You know, there's a rental car company I don't use very much, but the few times I do, I've always thought that their cars smell a little dirty. I wonder if it's the same one.
Yeah. Big green logo starts with an E.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and I love these guys. I love the company. They've always got the right prices and everything. I tend never to have a problem getting what I need from them, but every once in a while, I'll get a car that requires like major, you know, cleaning. And we went on vacation this past week, and then Army of Ants started to invade the SUV we had rented. Sure enough, there's like three packets of saltine crackers underneath the chair and a soapbox derby car that the previous family had left behind. And anyway.
That leads me to think of stories that I probably really can't say here about when you buy a used car.
Yeah.
The things that happen in and around used cars.
Sure.
Because these car salesmen can take the cars as they will until it's sold. And they can do whatever they want in this. So, just so you know, when you're buying your next used car, watch out for strange things.
Yeah. Are we keeping the show rated G or PG?
I'm going to leave it there.
Yeah,
leave it there. Right, watch out for strange spots that you don't know what they are. I'm just saying, right now.
Too funny. Well, Ben, you got anything we should talk about today?
Well, I had a conversation with my mother just last night, and cars came up. Now, my dear mother just turned 80 years old, and she's still driving. She's got a Mazda minivan that she's loved for the past 15 years. And the conversation came around, things that work well for people in the older age group. We have a lot of aging Americans. The baby boomers are getting up there now. And I'd compared to her an experience that I had at the International Auto Show earlier this year, where I noticed a lot of new cars now. Yeah, the door sills may not be a problem getting your foot past, but as you put your foot on the ground, they've got a little strake on the body that sticks out. I'm not sure if it's more styling or aerodynamics, but a lot of times that was where I wanted to put my foot as I was getting out. And I'm a fairly young, able person. With the older set, it could be a real problem, but she said, you know, seat height is an issue. Also, the height of the door sill, the width of the door sill, the size of the door opening, where it is in relation to the seat, all these things can be tricky. And it's going to be interesting to see what manufacturers do to work around this. Now, as Americans age, the style of them changes. You remember when the World War II set was getting up in years, the big cushy Buick or Lincoln
sedan type
was, what they wanted. Now, cars like that aren't even made anymore. My stepfather wouldn't recognize the Cadillacs they're making now.
Right.
So as the boomers who have a little hipper sort of mindset age, how are they going to deal with their cars? It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, people just adapt and they get what they like.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And the SUVs, high seats work for some people, but they don't work for others. And some of them do have the door sill issues.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine had an old Jeep Cherokee that, it's one of the long gone ones from the 90s, but... You know, the door sill on it was probably, about 6-8 inches deep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez. Well, it is a truck.
Yeah.
So, although the new Jeep Cherokee, I've heard, is a a modified Chrysler minivan.
Yeah, it's much more car-like.
Yeah, I've heard it's not so good thing about it.
I saw one yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those quick, oh, is that what that was?
Yeah.
It doesn't remind me in any way, shape, or form of them. And yeah, I think like many of the other cars that claim to be SUVs or sometimes trucks, I think it's really just sitting on a car frame. Mm-hmm.
I've driven one as a rental car a couple of times, and if what you need is a family car, it's perfectly fine. The way Jeep is doing it now, if you want to drive off-road, they're not going to sell you a Cherokee, they're probably going to sell you a Wrangler.
Right.
The Cherokee has become a family vehicle, and so it's good at doing that.
Right. Tracy, our friend Tracy, recently drove one, and she hates it.
Ah.
Yeah. But there was something else I was going to say about the whole Jeep thing. Oh, not Jeep. Bronco. Bronco's coming back.
Yes, it is.
Yes, I have been posting about that. No, those pictures, they are saying in the fine print, this is not the final rendition.
Okay.
And if you read the articles, Ranger is also making a comeback. I know a couple of people that will be very excited about the Rangers making a comeback. What they're going to do to those Rangers is another thing. But yes, I don't know why. I'm super excited that they're bringing back the Bronco, and I'm waiting. I've actually asked some people if there's going to be a V8 option in it. But I like the concept that they've been sharing. It's along the lines of
it looks
still keeping true to it, but it's more updated.
Sure. I doubt they'll do the V8 because I thought I read this thing where that Ford was like straight to V6s.
That's a problem, and that could be a whole other tangent. I'm very angry that the Taurus SHO is a V6. I don't care how fast your V6 is going. I don't care if it's EcoBoost. You want to stick the SHO label on it, I want a V8 in there. You know, it's just one of those things.
Right.
So, yes, that has been one of my gripes. That's why, despite my love for Mustang, my regular car now is not a Ford product.
Yeah.
Ford stopped offering four-door V8 rear-wheel drive. So I had to betray Ford.
So disappointed.
I'm very disappointed.
Yeah.
I'd like to wag my finger at Ford.
My big hope with the new Ranger is that it has a more spacious cab than the old one. They were very cramped inside.
Mm. Well, I think that was part of the appeal because there were a lot of trucks to pick from. And a lot of trucks that were very large.
Right.
But this you would get the functionality but have a smaller vehicle. I know it might be a niche area. But
well, my dad needed a small truck at one time. He got just as much bed space, but with a much more spacious cab and an old beat-up 83 Isuzu.
Right.
I actually kind of liked when I was seeking a four-door option. I don't know. Maybe this is really weird. I kind of liked the Sport Track. It doesn't have a true bed.
Right.
It's only a sort of bed. I get that. You know, it wouldn't have been incredibly functional. But I kind of like the way they look.
Yeah.
I just wasn't happy with the way they were wearing. Because by the time I was looking for them, they weren't being produced anymore.
Right.
And I wasn't entirely sure the longevity of anything being bought.
Sure, yeah. But the idea was pretty cool.
It was interesting.
I mean, where do we go from here? I think it makes sense to talk about the whole V6 versus V8 thing and where the industry's going. Because for a while, the market changed. And so certain engines became not so popular or even not that viable for a while. And now the market's changing again.
Right.
Right. So what I'm trying to illustrate here is something like, okay, some of our favorite cars like the Honda Prelude and the Toyota Supra disappeared. And now the Supra's coming back. There's rumors that a Prelude's coming back on the market. And so let's look at the engines, the engine transition. In the meantime, technology has improved. So as the market's changing, so has the need for bigger, more powerful engines. And so that's why we don't see the V8s anymore, because you can get a whole lot more out of a V6 than you used to.
But you say need as, like it's a functional part of the vehicle, like, it needs four wheels.
Right.
I don't think it's about what we need. I think it's about certain passions and love that people have involved with certain vehicles. You know, that it's not necessarily that it's the most practical car or something that they absolutely need, but they want that V8.
Sure. But if you can make a V6 that outperforms a V8, isn't that better?
I think there's something attached to it. I don't know. Maybe for some people it's like buying a name brand. You can buy something that's perfectly good and functions exactly the same with a generic label on it, and some people just really want the name, the brand name on it, and I think it's kind of like that. Yes, you can make a V6, I've even seen some very impressive four cylinders along the way, but it's that name brand of, I have a passion for cars and I like them to be V8s, mm-hmm. and that's the name brand I want it to be, you know, want to be on it, the V8.
Mm-hmm. Well, not all V8s are created equally either, too,
no,
though, because if
not
you...
Not nowadays. For it's instance, all electronic nowadays. You yes. can get
well,
some
that's
more
not
power.
Even where I'm going. Things like exhaust note, for instance. A lot of people like that good old V8 burble, that particular way they sound.
Yeah.
Well,
the
you might get more performance from a flat plane crank design, but it doesn't make that same sound. Also, there are some pretty lousy V8s in history, too. Think of some of the American ones in the 70s and 80s. They were selling Corvettes at one time with 180 horsepower V8 in it.
Yeah.
You know,
unconscionable.
And you can
but
make
times
some,
have changed as
yes,
far
they have.
As.
Yes, they have. You can do anything good or bad. So it's a matter of what we're willing to commit to.
So you're
to.
Saying it does really remain a matter of personal preference?
I think so.
And yes.
If a person wants an optional V8, they should be able to get one.
Exactly.
So if someone, such as myself, does not know what a V8 is, how would you explain this?
Well, it's
so Misty.
It could be a long or a short answer.
Well, the number is the number of cylinders. It's 8 cylinders, and they call it a V because they're arranged in 2 banks of 4 that are at an angle to each other. And I'm making visual aids nobody can see.
Right.
But
although that angle can change.
Yes. Right. There have been lots of different angles over the years. There was a Cadillac V12 or V16 back in the 1930s that had a 120-degree angle between the banks. There
12
are some,
cylinders, 6 on each side.
Yeah.
So.
But generally in the shape of a V. Not necessarily
right.
the same angled V,
right.
but in the shape of a
yeah,
V.
Yeah, the crankshaft's at the bottom and the pistons angle out upward on 2 sides from it. Yeah, I think most American V8s are about a what of...
The thing is, though, the thing you look out for is the number of the cylinders and the shape of the engine. So you have something less like my Volvo, which has an inline 6. It's not a V. It's just a straight line of 6 cylinders.
Sometimes
right.
called an I-6.
An I-6.
You'll
yeah.
see it. But then you can go further. There are the boxers
yep.
or the pancake
flat.
Engines.
Right. Horizontally opposed.
And this one goes out to my husband, who thought that his Honda Civic was a V4 when I met him. Generally,
well, we
if you're talking
laugh.
About a four-cylinder engine, oh no, please laugh, because I laughed so hard I actually fell onto the driveway.
Well, Honda does make V4s in motorcycles.
Well, see, I was gonna kind of go that way. Generally speaking, if you have a four-cylinder, it is not a V.
Right.
It's an inline four-cylinder, however you want to refer to it. It's not going to be a V. That's not to say there hasn't been V4s
right.
produced, at least on a small scale, but they found that it wasn't helping it was hurting it.
Saab did
power.
Them back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a really good trivia thing that goes into that.
Oh, wow.
A lot of people don't realize that Mustang's origins, it's always going to be Mustang if I open my mouth, sorry.
Of course, yeah.
Mustang's origins go way back further than when we first saw the cars come out. So back in 1962 was when the first Mustang prototype was built. It was a two-seater with a mid V4 engine.
I've seen it. It's in the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn. It's a really cute little car.
But the Thunderbird was a two-seater at the time, and
right.
they felt like they already had something in that market. It wasn't the direction they wanted to go.
Right.
So they have been out there, but not widely used.
Cool. Does that make sense, though? About
I
the
understand what it is, but how does it make the car work?
Actually, not meaning to take any conversations away from here, but sometimes it's really better to see how things work, how stuff works. Am I saying the right one? HowStuffWorks.com? They'll actually have animated diagrams
yeah.
that can
oh, yeah.
help you through the process where you're not only seeing the outside, but cutaways of the inside in cartoon, and it'll show you different motions so you can much
right.
easier visualize what the process is.
And,
okay.
and what you're about to see with the V, like when we talk about cylinders on the in general, those are all internal combustion gas powered engines. When it comes to electrics, all that goes away.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Which I
so,
hate.
Yeah.
Well, that's funny too, and this is not really a car thing, it's a motorcycle thing. BMW are about to release an electric bike concept that actually apes their two-cylinder boxer engine, where they've got two electric motors where the cylinders would be on one of their gasoline engines. They connect to an internal gearbox, and it's a pretty cool idea. We'll have to see what we've only seen renderings of it so far, but when they show a real prototype, there are a lot of practical advantages to this.
Yeah.
I have something semi-off topic, more or less, along with that notion. Nowadays, with all of our technology, we've got phones that are microcomputers. We can be connected 24/7 wherever we are. We're coming out with electric cars, but I see a big collision of some bad things there. How many people have you seen step out in front of you in traffic looking at their phone, typing away, not paying any attention?
No.
Now, how fair is it to add cars that don't make a sound when they're coming at you?
That's been a problem for a long time.
At least before you could hear them coming, kind of.
I first got almost run over by a quiet car in 1988.
Quiet car in 1988?
It was a European Ford. I was in Germany. And it wasn't going very fast either. But I forgot my Cub Scout training. I did not look both ways. I was on a military base right in front of a barracks. It should be a low speed area anyway. But I didn't hear the car until I heard its tires screech.
But see, now tires don't screech that much with ABS. Right. They screech far less.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole distractibility thing. I think that there's a whole new, a new mode of conduct that people need to learn around their phones and what's acceptable behavior and what's not. I mean, I still drive down the road. As much as we know that texting and driving is bad, as much as everyone agrees that it's a horrible thing to do, at least 4 times a day I see it happen. At least.
Oh, yeah.
And it just makes me nuts. It makes me absolutely crazy. Put the phone down, just drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and passing laws about it is a mixed bag. Here in Georgia, for instance, we've had a no texting and driving law for some years now. It's been 3, 4, 5 years. And as of about a year ago, when I last read any statistics about it, it had resulted in a grand total of 6 convictions. Because they have a problem with evidence in court.
Yeah.
Sure, cops all have cameras, but they're not necessarily in the right place to catch this. Now, Australia has a great solution to this. They have motorcycle cops who have a helmet cam. You can see this on YouTube. You can see the video from these. You see what the cop sees. He sees the guy texting. He's talking in a little microphone. He's, reading off the car's plate number. He rides right up. Taps on the driver's window, says, "Hello, mate, I got you."
They also have a good app system, I can't remember what it's called, available in Australia, that limits the functionality of your phone in a vehicle while you're moving to, I believe, speaker or a headset, and I think maybe a map system. It sounded like a really good idea when I first heard about it, and I looked into it and realized, oh, only available in Australia.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and why can't they do that? Why can't they say if your phone's moving more than 15 miles an hour, you don't get to text?
Well, I think a lot of the companies, at least in the United States, are afraid that that's going to result in some business problems, not necessarily from drivers who want to be bad, but because their passengers won't be able to use them.
Right. Good point. So, all right, I think that may be a good place for us to stop this time. Thanks again for joining us. This is The Thing About Cars. We'll be releasing a couple episodes again soon. In the meantime, I got to give another shout out to our friends at Strong Box West for letting us record in their excellent space. Check them out at strongboxwest.com. We will see you soon.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.